Thank you. Okay, so Guillaume had told you about the light curves of the outbursts and how outbursts of transient systems and how we think they might be produced. And I'm going to try to get into the nitty-gritty of how we think the actual spectra that we see in X-rays are produced. And in the spirit of the conference, I'll try to give you a very broad overview of what we know and what we don't know. And unfortunately, I think the conclusion would be that we actually still don't know very much. Okay, so here's a brief outline. For those of you who are not quite familiar with what spectral states are, I'll give a brief review of their properties. And then I'll ask sort of the most fundamental question you can, and that is, what actually drives the transition from one state to the other? And in some sense, we think we actually do know the answer to that question. Then I'll talk about the constraints from observations on various models that have been proposed for those spectral states. And instead of conclusions, I have a three pages of remaining questions that are in my mind still important to answer before we think we actually know what's going on. Okay, so here's the three main spectral states on which I will be concentrating in this talk. And the nomenclature, low, high, and very high state, basically it's historical and it's based on their luminosity in the soft X-ray band. And so the low state, but of course the important thing is not the luminosity per se, but what the spectra look like. The low state is a very hard one, with most of the luminosity coming out around 100 keV. Then you have a very, very soft high state, where you have this very prominent soft black body component, and then perhaps a long parallel tail, but the power in the parallel tail is very much smaller than that in the soft component. And then you have a very high state. It has the highest overall luminosity, it has something that looks like it might be a black body component, and it also has a very strong and prominent parallel component. Not only, no, I hate laser pointers. Thank you, though. Okay, not only the spectra are different in those spectral states, but to emphasize that the physical flow that's producing it's probably fundamentally different, the variability properties of the states are very different. The high state that has least high energy emission has also least variability. The low state and very high states are much more variable, and very high states show those incredible QPOs that Rudy was talking about, I think, on Tuesday. Low state also shows some QPOs, but they're weaker and have lower frequency in general. This is a table that summarizes all the properties, both temporal and spectral, of the spectral states, and you could see that there are actually five spectral states. I showed you spectra of three that, to my mind, are the main ones, low, high, and very high state. There is the quiescent state that Guillaume had mentioned, and I'm not going to talk about it too much, partly because there's too much controversy about those non-radiative accretion flows, and partly because we really don't have very many observational constraints. So it's kind of, there's not much to say. Then there is the intermediate state, which I won't mention too much, and it's basically what you see is a transition between the low state to the high state. So the spectrum starts like this and ends up like this, and you see a whole series of spectra in between, and they all class as intermediate state spectra. Okay, so the most fundamental question that you can ask is, well, what is actually connecting all these spectral states together? What is the one parameter, if there is such a thing, that controls which state that you see the system in? And it turns out that there actually seems to be such a parameter, and it's mass accretion rate. And it's very easy to see that this is indeed the case if you look at the light curves of some of the typical, quote-unquote, transient sources. And here I have the light curves of two of them, one that Guillaume had already shown you, AO620, and another is a GRS1125-24, another popular name for it is Novomanski. So the light curves are almost identical. If you can't tell one from the other, that's okay. And the main thing is that when you look at what the spectra are doing, you can divide this whole light curve into four distinct regions. Then this is a very high state, this is a high state, the low state is at lowest luminosities, and then there is an intermediate state between the high and the low state. So this soft X-ray emission seems to follow the mass accretion rate. And you see the same sequence of states in many of the systems. Sometimes you don't see some. For example, if the systems don't burst high enough, you don't see very high state. Sometimes you don't even see high state. Systems like 1118 have fairly low luminosity, even at the peak of their outburst, and so they're only found in the low state. But in general, mass accretion rate that you infer for the system corresponds to what you think, and then you look at the spectrum and it corresponds to what you think the spectral state should be at that mass accretion rate. So it really does seem that the mass accretion rate is the fundamental parameter that drives transition from one state to another. In support of this, several groups have been able to look at the rise to outburst. And it's much harder to see because, of course, rise happens just over very, very short time, maybe a few days. So the data coverage is generally pretty sparse. But at least in two systems, AO620 and in J1550, you see also this characteristic low to high state transition, or maybe I should say better, hard to soft state transition, because it's not clear whether the state that it transits to is actually high or very high state. Okay. So you expect that during the rise, the mass accretion rate is increasing, so you go from low to high state, and then during the decline, as the mass accretion rate is decreasing, you expect the reverse transition, and indeed that is what happens. And in addition, you can ask, well, what about the persistent sources? There are persistent sources that do not burst, and there are sources like Cygnus X1 and LMC X3, and they show spectral states that are very similar to some of the spectral states that are displayed by the transients, namely, for example, low and high spectral states. And we know now that Cygnus X1 and LMC X3 was recently also discovered to make the same transition from low to high state and back. And if this whole picture is to be consistent with this mass accretion rate hypothesis, you expect that this transition occurs roughly at the same mass accretion rate in these systems as it does in the transients. And it seems that it indeed does do so. So I should say, I would say at this point that it is clear that the mass accretion rate plays the main role in driving the spectral state changes. And in addition, I would also argue that there must exist some critical mass accretion rate values, which basically tell you where the transition should occur. And the persistent sources are good systems on which to argue this, because you don't expect the mass accretion rate in them to vary very much. So if you see, for example, low to high state transition in LMC X3, the total luminosity doesn't vary very much. So the mass accretion rate, therefore, probably shouldn't vary very much. And yet you see this drastic changes. So there should be some sort of a critical value for the mass accretion rate at which something happens. And we would really like to know what is it that is happening at those mass accretion rates. Of course, you can't really answer that question unless you build a real physical model for each spectral state. And many of such models were proposed for all of the spectral states. And I'm going to try to tell you now what kind of constraints we can place on those models from observations. So I'll start with lowest luminosity, low state. This is basically a very brief summary of what we see. In optical, we see signatures of normal Shakur and Tsunaev cool disk. Of course, optical observations tell us only about the outer parts of the disk. So you expect that at least in those outer parts, you have this cool disk. However, it's very well known to all of you that Shakur and Tsunaev disk cannot produce the kind of high-energy X-ray emission that we see in a low state, namely 100 keV photons. Instead, you need plasma with temperatures, well, about 10 to the 9 to 10 to the 10 Kelvin, depending on the source, and optically thin plasma that would produce that high-energy emission. And in addition, there is this extra, so it looks like, well, you might have two component model, the cool accretion disk and this hot thermal plasma that would give you the high energy photons. But then there's this pesky radio emission that Rob will tell you much more about in the next talk, and it seems to be a strong correlation between radio and high and hard X-ray emission. So there's a very strong suggestion that there's also some sort of non-thermal plasma present in the system, and maybe there's an outflow or a jet that might mess up this nice picture of just having a two-component model. Nonetheless, for now, I would really only focus on the two-component model because we really don't know that much about jets at this point. And I'll leave Rob to deal with jets. So if you forget about jets, then there's really two very general models that one can propose. And it basically it basically just depends on geometry. And the point is, where is it that you put that hot plasma? Okay? Well, you can say that you really have just the simplest possible model. The disk goes down to the marginally stable orbit, and then somewhere on top and on above and below the disk, you place the cloud of hot plasma. And this is, of course, the famous corona model. There are various incarnations of the corona model. Corona could be thick, or it could be hugging the disk. It could be static, or it could be it could be time-dependent based on magnetic flares that go on above the disk. But basically, it's all the same idea. And the other model is this hot accretion flow model. And what you do is you truncate the disk at some transition radius, and then you fill the hole, the resulting hole in the disk, with a hot flow. And at the first glance, it seems that, well, there isn't really that much difference between these two models. In both cases, you have a cool disk and you have a hot plasma, so why really worry about this? But there is one fundamental difference, and that is, in this picture, in the disk and corona picture, disk takes care of angular momentum transfer, even if corona takes care of energy dissipation. But here, you don't have a disk in the inner region. So you can't just describe this hot flow as a static corona. You have to put in some sort of angular momentum transfer, which complicates things quite a bit. But on the other hand, you have more constraints from the model in this case. And then, of course, both of these pictures could have jets appended to them. And again, that would complicate things very much. So what kind of observational diagnostics do we have for the low state? And of course, the main question we really want to answer here is, how far in does the thin disk extend? Okay? And there's really three sort of fundamental ways we can address this. Two of them we already talked about extensively in this conference on Tuesday, I believe. And one is, of course, modeling the reflection component in iron K alpha line. And the other is has to do with interpretation of variability that we see, and primarily with the interpretation of QPO frequencies. And then a simpler way, perhaps, is just to try to observe the inner edge of the disk. You try to model the disk emission. You try to measure the temperature of this disk emission, and you try to then work backwards and infer what is the inner radius of the disk that this requires. I won't talk much about this, mostly because it's already been covered and I don't have very much time, but I'll give you sort of conclusions that come from this point number one and number two, and I'll focus more on number three. Okay. So the problem with observing the innermost disk is, of course, the absorption, right? In a low state, the disk emission peaks way below 1 keV. And this is where interstellar absorption becomes a real, real problem. Not only that, but we really didn't have very good spectral instruments before Beposex, Chandra, and XMM that had sensitivity in the band, say, of a few hundred eV or so. But the absorption really is a much bigger problem. So I only, to my knowledge, there's only been two systems, 1118 and Cygnus X1, for which in the low state, the component coming from the thin disk was, well, convincingly, I should say, measured, detected. Okay? And 1118 is by far a better example because you can see this really nice broadband spectrum. RXT, Chandra, EUV, optical spectrum, and even some infrared points. And you can see that this peak of the black body component, so the emission of the thin disk, peaks at around 60 EV. Okay? So you infer that the temperature for the disk, it says 30, it's actually 20 to 25 EV. Okay? This is inconsistent with any corona model that I could come up with. The limiting disk temperature for a corona model would be maybe between 100 and 200 eV. 25 eV is just way too low. And the best fit model with a hot flow and a truncated disk gives us the inner radius of about 60 Schwarzschild radii. Now, Beposex observations of Cygnus X1. Of course, the absorption to Cygnus X1 is much greater. So you don't see anything like this nice black body component you see in 1118. But the authors claim that a black body component is nonetheless necessary to obtain a decent fit to the model, no matter what other model you use for the hard emission. And they come up with, depending on the model, but the reasonable sort of lowest temperature for the thin disk, they come up with this 130 eV. And this is probably marginally consistent with the corona model. So the inner disk radius that they come up with varies anywhere between 3 Schwarzschild radii, which is of course a marginally stable orbit for a Schwarzschild black hole, and 35 Schwarzschild radii. So I would say that that's perfectly consistent with both a corona model or a hot flow model. So what have we really learned about the low state? Well, first let's start with modeling of reflection in iron K alpha line. For a while it really did seem like in a low state the reflection is suppressed. For a while, maybe 3 years ago or so, both the reflection was seemed to be suppressed and the iron K alpha line seemed pretty weak and narrow. However, now we know more about reflection models than we knew then. And if you ask Sergey Nayakshin, he'll tell you that there's really two explanations. I think that's what he'll tell you. You could have either a truncated disk that would suppress the reflection fraction, or you could simply have an ionized disk. And this is very sensible because you have this huge high-energy X-ray flux that will ionize the top of your disk, and that would act as a mirror suppressing the reflection. What about interpretations of QPOs? Well, Dimitrios Saltis talked about it on Tuesday. And basically, we really don't have still any real physical model for how those QPOs are produced. But you could use some scaling arguments, which point, in this case, that the inner disk radius is a few times larger than the radius of an innermost stable orbit in some low-state systems. And for example, if you apply the same arguments to the very high state systems, they do seem more consistent with the radius of the innermost stable orbit. But those few, I must point out that those few times larger is not big enough to accommodate the sort of the hot flow model as we know it, namely the ADAF. Okay? It's the radius, the transition radius is simply too small. You would never produce spectra hard enough with an ADAF to explain low state systems. So that's also, I would say that that's both seems to be inconsistent with both the ADAF and the corona model. And finally, modeling the disk emission, we got two results. 1118, I believe, is completely inconsistent with the corona model. Cygnus 6-1 is consistent with both. But these are both, you could call, atypical systems. Cygnus 6-1 isn't even a transient. Persistent source, so it might be that in a low state, persistent sources are different because they're fed from a wind, by a wind from a companion, so the specific angular momentum of accreting matter is different, so things could be quite different in here. J1118 seems to be a normal transient apart from its light curve. As I told you, it's never went into the very high or high state, and it's set in a low state with constant luminosity for a very, very long time, I think more than a month, or maybe even 2 months. If you ask Guillaume Debus, that's kind of problematic for explaining it with a normal disk instability model. So it's really hard to say which one is atypical. Maybe both of them are atypical, and we haven't really learned anything about the typical transient systems from this. So let me now move on to the soft state spectra, high and very high state. And I will start with the high state. Because after all, high state seems to be the nicest. You seem to see this nice disk emission and then maybe just a little bit of high energy emission to mess things up for you, but it seems to be not to be at least dominating the spectrum. So in a high state, the cool disk signature is clearly present. And the characteristic temperature is between 0.1 to maybe 0.5 keV, something like that. Perfectly consistent, well, at least in a qualitative sense, with Shakur and Tsunayev model. Then you have this high energy parallel tail, and here you start having problems again. The parallel tail extends in many cases beyond 500 keV, so it cannot be thermal plasma that's producing it. And even if you assume that the corona model is valid for, say, low state, the cutoff energy in a high energy emission there is about 100 keV. So even if it's the same kind of model that's producing both of the states, the energy distribution for the electrons in the corona, in the hot component, seems to be very different. So the high energy emission in a high state is really reminiscent of non-thermal particles. You probably require non-thermal particles to produce it. So we go back to this jet idea, except that in a high state, there is no radio emission, and I think that's right, isn't it? There is no radio emission in the high state. So it doesn't seem to fit together very well. And finally, there's some evidence that, at least for some systems, the standard alpha disk model cannot fit the spectrum. It's too broad, doesn't really look like a black body, and what you need is this extra thermal comptonization of black body component with a higher temperature of about 5 keV. And I believe the optical depth of this extra component should be a few, maybe from 1 to 3. So it looks like you have a cool disk with some really hot non-thermal corona above it, and then maybe a hot, slightly hotter ionized layer on top of the cool disk. But the high state has bigger problems. If you draw this standard m dot versus sigma, this is the surface density of the accretion disk diagram, the high state is smack in the middle of both viscously and thermally unstable Lightman-Nordli branch right here. So what's going on? We know that if Shikorin-Tsunayev model is valid, we know that the disk should be both viscously and thermally unstable. But we also know that the high state is the least variable of all spectral states. And in fact, whatever variability there is, it's all in a hard non-thermal component. The power law, the soft energy power law, just stays as constant as you could make it. So what's going on? Well, perhaps numerical simulations of radiation pressure-dominated disks can clarify the situation a little bit. We heard, I believe yesterday, from Neil Turner that thermal instability, well, we've known for a long time that thermal instability could be avoided if viscosity is proportional to the gas pressure rather than the total pressure. It sort of makes a lot of sense if the thermal instability is because the disk is radiation pressure-dominated and you sort of throw out the radiation pressure out of your equation, and only P gas is important, then you get rid of the thermal instability. And I believe Neil Thurmer thinks that there's maybe some indication from his simulations that that's the case. But it's by no means a definitive answer. Viscous, but then even if you get rid of that, you're still left with viscous instability. And there, things are even more complicated. But again, I'm going to... There was a vague suggestion made to me by Eric Eagle last week, so this is really on a level of almost rumors here, that if you produce clumps in the disk, as Neil seems to see in his simulations, you will change the opacity of the disk and you will change the structure of the disk maybe enough to get rid of even the viscous instability. But all this is very uncertain, very unclear, and you have to sort of do a lot more physics in order to believe any of this and get rid of both instabilities. So this is the biggest problem, as I see, with a high state. Finally, the very high state. You see a bit of a soft component, and then this very strong, also non-thermal power law. And again, the pesky radio emission raises its ugly head. And so there must be jets. There must be jets in the system, which again will mess up everything, sort of all the old concept of how this state should work. Because if there's radio emission, and as Rob will show you, is strongly correlated with high energy emission, then perhaps at least some of the high energy emission is produced by a jet. And so you can just throw out all these old models of disk and corona just out the window. Moreover, there are other problems with the very high state models, and that is that the emission can approach Eddington limit and maybe even exceed it in some cases. We simply don't know the masses and the distances well enough to say that it never exceeds the Eddington limit. So the Shikorin-Tsunayev disk is really not a good description in this limit, and we have to go to something like a slim disk. And there have been numerous papers written on the slim disk, which give sort of dynamical description of the flow, but there's really no spectral models that we could apply to the data. So the observers are still fitting the black body disk and the power law component, and it really gives you very little physical information. Finally, what about trying to test things with modeling reflection components in soft spectral states? Because at least we believe that in those states, the cooler disk has to extend down to the marginally stable orbit, and so you should see broad lines and strong reflection components. Well, at least this does seem to work. There are various papers claiming a detection of smeared reflection components that do come from highly ionized plasma. And there's at least one very strong claim of a detection of a very broad ion line in J1650 that you heard from heard about from Chris earlier this week. Even in that, there is a bit of a caveat. I go back to the spectra. You can see that if you try to model reflection in iron line in a low state, at least you have the advantage that your continuum seems to be well behaved. And in many cases, people just fit a power law to it, and it seems to do a fairly good job if you know how to model your reflection component. In a high state, in a very low, in a very high state, you have this black body component, and then you have a power law component, and the iron line sits smack in the middle where the two components meet. And so what you do with the two components, how you fit them, affects very much what happens to the width and equivalent width of your line. And so that's why, just like I think just like it is the case for AGN, when there are different instruments looking at the same object and there are different people reducing the data, they get different results. And so lines appear, disappear, and there is endless argument about it. And it, again, goes back to the fact that we don't know how to model the continuum. We really don't have a good physical model for those states. Okay, so I come to my conclusions, and I still have 10 minutes left. So maybe I was too fast, yes? So remaining questions is, maybe there's more important questions, but that's at least the most important that I could come up with. So in a low state, I think the main question is, well, what is the deal with truncation of the disk? We know that at least in one system it must be truncated. So we can ask, well, how often is it truncated? Are persistent systems in general simply different from transients? And then 1118 is a typical transient, and Cygnus X1 is a typical persistent source. Or maybe 1118 is different from all the others, and then some transients are different from other transients. And if, but then there's this problem, if you say, well, there's one mechanism that makes low state in some systems and another in other systems, why is the variability completely the same in all of the systems? If you plot the power density spectra versus frequency, basically you have very typical low state power density spectrum. If the disk is not truncated, and and so you invoke disk and corona model to produce a low state, then it's not at all clear what is the mechanism that's driving low to high state transition. At least in the model that relies on the hot flow, there is a fairly good mechanism, and that is basically there is a critical mass accretion rate above which the hot flow basically just becomes, it cools too fast, and it doesn't exist anymore. And so once you go above that mass accretion rate, then your only alternative is disk plus corona. But if you don't rely on that, then there's really no good sort of convincing mechanism why you go from a really strong corona-dominated situation to a situation where corona emission is very, very weak, like it is in a high state. There is this little point that I didn't tell you about. When I told you that the rise, the change spectral state transitions during the rise actually support our argument towards the fact that the mass accretion rate is driving these transitions, it actually happens that the low, and then in the case of a rise, very high state transition occurs at a luminosity factor of 10 roughly greater than the corresponding transition during the decline phase. So on one hand, it explains the fact why is it that we skip a high state in a process. But it's very, very hard to understand this in the context of an ADAF model. It's really a big problem. Since in the corona model, we really don't know what's driving the transition, maybe it's less of a problem. But at least this, this tells you that maybe the history of where the object, where it's coming from, it's also important. Because as Guillaume told you, in quiescence, you really have to have a hole in the disk. So maybe it takes more time than we think to fill up that hole during the rise. And then when you're declining, you actually have to evaporate the material. So you have delay in both cases that contributes to this factor of 10 in luminosity. But it doesn't really work. I mean, it's sort of, it's a nice qualitative argument, but quantitatively, it's very hard to make it work in an ADAF model because there exists this critical mass accretion rate above which you really cannot go. And finally, there's this question of jets. If there are jets, do they play a role in forming the high energy spectrum? And if they do, then what are we doing ignoring them? And maybe that's all there is. Maybe all the high energy spectrum is coming from jets, and messing about with corona and hot accretion flows is just totally useless. And then the question is again, do they form high energy spectrum in all systems, or just in some systems? And then how does the presence of jets relate to the position of the inner disk radius? Some models of jets actually require hot flow, so they couldn't work with the disk and corona models, for example. And finally, what about variability? If some spectra of some systems are formed by a jet and some by a hot flow or disk and corona model, again, why is the variability so similar from one low state to another? Moving on to the high state, the biggest question really is, why does the disk appear to be stable? How do we avoid those thermal and viscous instabilities that should be present based on on the analytical models? And if the analytical models are wrong, then what are we doing fitting the spectra based on the analytical models to the data? Then it's totally unclear what is driving the transition to the very high state, which happens fairly suddenly. In the context of the corona model, if the corona model is valid both for the low state and the high state, as I already told, I think I already mentioned this, why is the cutoff energy of the power law component so much larger than in a high state than it is in a low state? So why is the corona appears thermal in a low state and non-thermal in a very high state? Okay. If there is indeed energy extraction from within the innermost stable circular orbit, then what effect does it have on the disk spectrum? Maybe that would explain this extra thermal black body or comptonization component that we need in fitting some of this spectra. So we really have to understand that. And then this problem with the rise, is this trait truly absent during the rise phase? And if so, why is it absent? And it relates to the fact why there is this hysteresis and when the transition occurs during the rise and during the decline. And finally, why is there no radio emission in this state? And the very last transparency, the very high state. Well, for that, we really just need a physical model describing the emission from near or super Eddington accretion flows. Okay. And then there's this question, if the disk become very clumpy, as suggested by numerical simulation of radiation-dominated accretion flows, then what effect does it have on spectral properties and on the timing properties? And then there's this, again, little point which I haven't mentioned before. It turns out that if you look at the variability properties at the PDF spectra, power density spectra of the very high state, they look really, really similar to intermediate state. Intermediate state also shows this kind of noise at low frequencies and plateau, and then a decline and strong QPOs. Well, it really is not clear why those two states should be so similar in terms of their variability. And finally, again, what contributions do jets make to X-ray spectrum? Because we know that in that state, the radio emission is very prominent. That's all. Which is what?
Big question, the most important one. Please,
big question.
Quite a few of them.
Well, I really don't want to do that. I mean, it's. I don't know. I mean, to me, I mostly. Most of my work has been in a low state, so to me, you know, I'm really concerned about this disk truncation issue. But I think it depends on who you ask. And there might be just as important questions in the very high and high state, and it's just that we haven't worked on them long enough to really understand that.
What is going on?
Well, yeah, I mean, you can put it that way, yes. What is going on?
I want to make a comment, but yeah. I think I can easily answer this question. Is that if you believe in the corona model, then the big question is how to make this corona and to describe the property of the corona. If you believe in the ADAF, in the general sense model, why this disk is evaporated? What is the mechanism? And we have some hints, but we don't have a model. So in both cases, it's what what and how is the hot gas produced, and we don't have an answer. On the other hand, we have partial answer, because you cannot have it any both ways. If you have a hole in a quiet, and I think this is required by the by the model, because if you don't want it, then you have to construct an alternative model for the outburst, and then I wish you luck. So if you're in a quiescent state, you will still have in the low state.
Well, it's a question of degree. What do you call low state? There is two orders of magnitude in luminosity, right? But I know, but I want to. you can close your ears. There's two orders of magnitude difference in luminosity between quiescence and low state. Somewhere during the rise, at least, well, and during the decline as well, somewhere during that time, the hole is presumably filled in.
Yeah, sure.
So, and then the question is, by the time you actually see bright low state, is it filled in or is it not?
In fact, it is your fault and please stand beyond.
Yeah. Okay. But, yeah.
Just a brief comment about the 1650 spectra. The black body temperature we measure is only about 0.3 keV. Mm-hmm. So crossover between the black body spectrum and the quantization spectrum is not a concern.
It's not a concern there. I don't know how much of a very high spectrum it is either. I mean, how high the luminosity? We really don't know that. Yeah.
I think that this was in the case of we can rule out most versions of the corona model. And for example, in 661, we have this different correlation between the flux and index and reflection and index. And then when you invert it out, they basically rule out the corona model. And about ionization of the inner disk, this also is a problematic issue. I mean, in order to make a corona in which the disk is completely ionized, then the problem is that you still get black body emission.
Right.
Because even if your disk is 100% ionized, the peak of the emission is at, say, 100-200 keV, and then the albedo is low, so you still would generate black body that would pull your plasma. So I think it's much. Most of the evidence is for hot inner flow.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think one has to. I was trying to take the least sort of questionable approach to this, considering that it's not my work, Cygnus X1. So I can say that. I know that the temperature marginally can be fit by a corona, but whether it's another consistent with reflection, I don't know.
One of the original predictions of Chacon Tsarnaev was alluded to the 1/3 spectrum. Mm-hmm. Do you see that anywhere? At any energies, maybe at low energies, but absorption is.
There's in some systems, you do see it in the optical. But as Rob will tell you, as soon as you go into the infrared, I'm sorry, Rob, you have to tell him everything now. As soon as you go, like in 1118, even already in infrared and in low energy optical emission, you see a different slope. It's not new to the 1/3 anymore. And it's because it's probably non-thermal sort of jet emission that's dominating that. Not in the radio.
It's true if you have black body emission. If you're irradiated, you're actually pretty new to the -1, which you see, actually you get quite close to.
But we have, I mean, in our model for 1118, we do have irradiation, quite a lot of it, and it's still not enough to explain even infrared.
The X-ray simply cannot make it down to the disk. We can scatter it and go out again. So you get a much less of the reprocessed thermal emission and the temperature is correspondingly lower. So I in fact produce spectra, but have very little black body. There's no power to publish it because it's a public point on me.
Do you have reduced albedo, say, 200 keV?
See, that's why I don't want to get into this.
Yeah. Well, I'll show you the spectrum.
Well, here it's actually very simple. Even if you assume eta, quote unquote.
Well, don't make any assumptions,
because you know the mass of the equation. You don't
know how much the mass of the equation is.
It's
best.
No, you don't.
Not the absolute value, but.
You don't. You don't know anything. I mean, if you assume, you can assume from, for example, for the outburst models, like the Guillaume produces.
So can you argue that the changes are called a fixed
monotonic?
Is it possible to imagine that the mass accretion rate is fixed, mm-hmm. but efficiency is changing?
I think it would be real hard to do this, especially because you have very high and high state, which you rely on a thin disk to produce most of the emission. So there you know the efficiency is fixed. Even in the low state, even if you rely on ADAF to produce a low state, it's kind of a critical ADAF where the efficiency is not very different. It's not those super non-radiative accretion flows at really low mass accretion rates. So your efficiency doesn't change that much over the sort of range of mass accretion rates that I'm talking about.
It's changing, because the radius is changing. No, it's...
Well, not quite.
If you when you are filling the hole, of course, the efficiency is changing.
But again, this is we're talking about the time when the hole is already all filled. It's all nice thin disk and so on.
Okay.
Yeah. Even in the low state, when there is a hole, that inner flow is fairly radiatively efficient. Well, yes, if you want to really do a rigorous test, we cannot do it because we don't know what the mass accretion rate is doing. But from point of view of both models, it's not also terribly important because both have fairly constant efficiency over that range that we're talking about. Yeah, it's just theoretical prediction. And it seems to be not contradicted by what we see. So I have... I see no reason to mess with it, maybe. That's a good way of putting it.
Right. Yeah, just two comments, really. Mm-hmm. First, about the suggestion that the transition accretion rate mm-hmm. is different on the way up and the way down. Mm-hmm. That's true, but probably has nothing to do with filling a hole because it's already been quiet for a long time, because that is seen in persistent sources. Anything that's hovering around, say, plus or minus mm-hmm. a few percent Eddington, LMCX3, mm-hmm. as it's going up and down through its transitions, it shows exactly the same hysteresis. Cygnus X1, even if it doesn't mm-hmm. go all the way quiet, it's exactly the same hysteresis as GX329-4, as this was actually pointed out a long time mm-hmm. ago, 1995 paper by Miyamoto. It's mm-hmm. sort of been known for a long while that it's the same in the persistent sources as in the transient sources. Mm-hmm. The other comment is that low state, high state might be islands, but if you look at these things enough, in terms of all properties, spectral, temporal, mm-hmm. radio properties, they might spend most of their time in these two separate islands, but you can see them enough, they fill in the diagrams always in between. So it's not really such a sudden transition. Like Ron Remillard could probably tell mm-hmm. you about this with the latest transition.
Ron Murray, back here.
Latest mm-hmm. transition of Cygnus X1 back in October between the low and high state. In terms of ASM colors and fluxes, mm-hmm. it basically just built into missing parts of the diaphragm.
Well, I never claimed that it has to be a sudden transition. If you look at Nova Maskelecker, for example, you have many days while it's in the intermediate state, so while it's doing the transition. All I'm saying is that the mass accretion rate can't be changing very much over that range.
It's not clear that the intermediate state is necessarily not just a very high state in a different flux. It's not clear that, I wouldn't say mass accretion rate. I think it's important, but it's certainly not the only parameter driving these transitions.
Well, I think I don't think I disagree with that at all, but to me it seems a little bit strange that the very high state and the intermediate state are the same states at low luminosity. I don't think you can really explain that very well with any model.
Okay, I think we should move on to the next talk.
Yeah.